That man was special. He was special to me personally.
He was my hero. He could do no wrong.
He was not perfect, and he was not a saint.
He pretty much was the lonely crusader.
Maverick.
A boxer.
He's human.
He was somebody you can't forget, that's for sure.
He wanted to make medical care as common as a cup of coffee. That was his favorite saying.
So that was his vision.
His medical care was excellent. He was well-trained. His mortality rate was very low.
You would think something that was a solution would be well-received.
But he struck a nerve.
The woman who couldn't get, you know, someone to assist. It's like right around here.
So they took her to the house?
Yeah.
So they would have taken to the house,
right,
to the kitchen.
Yeah,
and tried.
Yeah.
If I were to pick one story that probably changed his entire life and made him who he was, that was the story.
There was a woman that was in labor, a Hispanic woman, that the doctors wouldn't touch.
Remember, this is 1917 when he was born in Lockhart. There was still a lot of discrimination.
Hispanics in Lockhart were not able to get medical care. So they would come see my grandmother.
She would help deliver a lot of these women.
And my dad was there assisting. My grandmother was having some complications, so she instructs my dad to go find the doctor that would treat Miss Garcia. He was running, you know, to this facility, that facility.
But watching that, seeing a woman die, seeing a baby die, and watching his mother trying to save this woman, not being a physician.
That had a tremendous impact. He never, never forgot that.
1920 is one of these big moments in the United States. It's after World War I. It's after the armed phase of the Mexican Revolution. It's kind of the end of the progressive era, and we're moving into the establishment of Jim Crow nationally.
Texas, a white town. His skin color was different.
The things that he wanted to do were not really available. I don't know that he ever went in the front door anywhere. He always had to go in the back door. He recognized that throughout his life. You know, he couldn't just knock on the door or kick the door. He had to bang the door.
Always in altercations with other kids because of the way he was being treated or his brothers or sisters were being treated.
What got him into college, frankly, were his grades and his athleticism. But to get into medical school, that was a higher hurdle.
The medical schools in Texas at the time wouldn't admit him because he was a Lebanese liberal in the world of medicine.
Medical schools became more discriminatory and more racist. You had a lot more people who were able to access medical schools in the 1890s and the 1900s than they were in the 1920s and 1930s.
We don't actually have many medical schools. There are a lot of hurdles one has to jump over to become a physician. It's incredibly competitive at every step of the way. The idea is to sort of thin out the physician ranks.
It was well known that they had to limit the number of entrants into medical schools because you did not want to overwhelm a community with medical services because it would limit your capability of making an adequate living. They had to continue to make it a restricted service.
One undeniable effect of this is that health care is much more expensive in the United States.
He went and spoke to one of the biochemists at the university. His name was Bodansky.
In his interview with my father, you know, confirmed the reason really was they just were not admitting, you know, minorities into the school. As luck would have it, Dr. Bodansky had been on a visiting professorship at the American University of Beirut in Lebanon.
And he told my father, look, there's this new school that we just reviewed, just got its accreditation. You may want to try them. So he wrote him a note on a prescription pad, gave it to him. So my father got on a boat and went to Beirut. He went to the dean of admissions and he said, Dr. Bodansky says I can go to school here. And he gave them the prescription pad. They said, you put a lot of trust in this man to have traveled halfway across the world based on this note. We don't know anything about you. Well, they accepted him.
sometimes you know you're at the right place. And I think for him, it was a good landing.
I think those were the happiest days of his life when he was in school there.
He was doing something. He could make a difference. He was very involved in reaching out to these villages, doing inoculations, doing vaccines. And during World War II, he was involved in the North African theater and setting up 10 hospitals, MASH units, with very little equipment. The success rate that they had in these hospitals was outstanding. So when he came back, community hospitals were his version of those tent hospitals. Before he left, he was offered very prominent positions there, but he really was motivated to get back to Texas. He really felt what he had learned there, he could make an impact. You know, he could help Ms. Garcia.
Dr. Nasser's observations during his military service are remarkably prescient. He foresees one of the big issues with American healthcare, which is that it spends a lot more per capita, but when you actually look at the outcomes, there are actually a lot more middling. His inclination to kind of slim down, go back to basics, and not put the fancy tools before the actual problem to be solved, which is meeting the patient's need.
So he initially had moved to Hamilton. He wanted to be a country doctor. It wasn't enough. The volume wasn't enough. He wasn't busy enough. We moved to Garland, but he worked in Dallas.
He took a lot of pride in simplicity. He was not doing neurosurgery at these hospitals.
Well, he delivered babies. He pinned hips. He fixed fractures. He did general surgery and did some family medicine as well.
Oh, he wanted to show everybody you can provide good medical care at a reasonable price wherever it needed to be. At the time, the AMA was very powerful and they were supportive of each other, but they did not like that he could provide the same medical care at a fraction of the cost that they were providing care. The providers in a community would set prices for services, not so much what it cost, but they would agree upon a cost. Delivering a baby was $3,000 to $5,000. Dad was charging $400 to $500. C-sections were $750.
He charged less.
Anybody who is trying to step outside of the medical status quo at that time, which is a fee-for-service model, is regarded with suspicion by the American Medical Association. This is the Cold War context, and anybody who is bucking the trend, they see it as a path to socialism or communism.
Dad was a member of the AMA. He got behind in his dues. He sent the check in late, and they turned the check back to him.
And they used that as a reason to drop him. There's a lot of us who've been late on our dues. There's no fees, there's no penalties. Just pay the dues. We're happy to have you back.
This is I forgot to renew my driver's license timely. I mean, this is a simple, put your $20 in the mail and mail it in incident.
Told him he was no longer a member of the AMA and he was not welcome back into the AMA.
The AMA and state level medical societies have a huge outsized impact on health policy during this period. Medical societies dictate whether or not you're going to get hospital privileges. They facilitate referrals to one's practice. And for the most part, they are whites only, especially in the Jim Crow South.
It began a battle, you know, with the AMA that lasted for many, many years. His father, mother, sister were in Austin, and they were encouraging him, look, you know, you're going to be much better received. You know, here there's going to be better opportunity for you here. You can reach more people here, and we'll build a hospital.
When we first moved here, we lived in both sides of the duplex, and the Cooks lived in that yellow house right there. You look out the windows, that oak tree is looking out the window of one of the patient rooms there. So that roof line is the roof of the hospital. It goes back, and we'll see it better from the other side. But he would, you know, his room, my dad's room was about where that tree is right there. I mean, he'd walk out the door and in 20 steps, he's at the hospital.
Wow. So.
our home was adjacent to the hospital. A lot of the patient population were indigent, disenfranchised parts of the community. For the most part, they were people in South Austin and East Austin, predominantly East Austin.
It's really bad in that area, and that's where my dad wanted to be.
They would offer their trade to him, anything they could do in return for what he gave them in medical care. He loved these people. He would go to their church to get to know his patients. Number one, in his heart, he was a servant to God. And number two, to his patients. And family was real close.
You know, Herbert made it his religion to say that these people have to have care. He made it his religion.
Well, Dad thought of medicine not so much as a career, but as a devotion. He felt he was right alongside a priest.
He went to Mass daily. In fact, in the hospital, he used to have a chapel set up, and the priest would come there and serve Mass.
He thought the soul needed just as much medical attention as the body did.
His life was dedicated actually to God, service, and his family. I don't know where it started, but it never changed. The doors were open for all kinds of patients. He treated indigent, disenfranchised people, you know, wealthy people.
It was an amazing childhood, amazing. Dad knew no strangers. People of all walks of life were living with us for whatever reasons.
At our house, it's always full of people. And I'm talking about strangers.
You never knew who was going to be there when you came home. Visitors that were hippies. We had Dr. Spock, who had come to Austin on a lecture tour.
A lot of alcoholic priests. There were drug addicts.
People who were dodging the draft. And we would all be introduced to them and listen to their story. Dad thought it was important that we got to know them.
Sometimes it take a long time. Sometimes he talked 3 hours, and you know, for a kid to sit there for 3 hours, that's long.
Mom always saw to it that they were fed, and if they didn't have a place to sleep, they would sleep at the house.
It was a very full household.
She had a horrible accent. She could never say teeth.
They knew the day my mother made bread, and everybody in the neighborhood knew because they could smell it.
Big round. And we had two oven.
Little petite woman, and she could just fly from one corner to the other in the kitchen. She was fast.
And my mom could throw the bread.
She would fling them. She would stand in the middle of the kitchen, and she had one of those pizza boards. She would open the oven, slide it, lift the bread, and flip it over onto the dining room table.
Would make about 200 loaves a week.
And that bread be so hot. My friend would come over, and we'd get the bread in the butter sack, put the butter on it.
My mother, she was a nurse, but yet running the house.
Dad brought them in, but she kept them warm and fed.
She was with him lockstep in what his mission was.
She played an amazing part in all of this.
What we discovered as the years went on, he was a rock, but so was she. They were a team.
I would do anything for my parent, especially my mother, very special lady. I mean, she got a heart of gold.
She was my heroine. She was the soft side. You know, she was the heart. She was the heart of the family. And at the same time, she was the backbone.
He had a huge garden.
And we grow all the vegetables and, you know, for the patient at the hospital.
Tomatoes, bell peppers, green beans, eggplant, cabbage, lettuce. It's amazing how much you can grow on a couple acres of land.
He always told me pulling weeds from the garden was like cleansing your soul. And with every weed, you're cultivating, you're cleaning. And to watch something grow, he thought was just amazing. And he wanted to teach that to us.
For him, it was therapeutic. After surgery, he He was always, always in the garden.
My friends would circle around the neighborhood with their bikes because they knew if they came anywhere near, he'd put them to work too.
It's kind of like, I got to go home and do some homework. So see you. So they leave me. I think I'm traumatized about it.
At the time, there was a big hippie movement and gay movement, and they were all welcome in the hospital. In fact, some worked, you know, at the hospital. That was really not socially acceptable to the establishment, but he still treated the patients that he wanted to, the way that he wanted to.
I think he wanted to break down barriers.
1948 Hospital Construction Act also mandated that every emergency room had to accept people if they were going to get federal funds for emergency rooms. Texas Clinics decided to draw a hard line and say, like, even though we're getting federal funds, we're still not going to accept people we find to be undesirable. People were excluded from accessing medical care when they were in dire needs and sometimes left to die.
If you were for civil rights, if you advocated on the part of minority populations, one of the go-to attacks would be to brand you as a communist, a radical, somebody on the fringes who wanted to overthrow the society.
When we moved to Austin, he attempted to join the AMA there. His application was denied.
Deciding to practice medicine without being a member created both severe social penalties and severe financial penalties. First, you didn't get access to medical insurance. You couldn't get loans from banks to be able to improve your medical care because you weren't a certified doctor. And the only reason you could practice is because of the discrimination against large parts of the Texas community.
If you didn't belong to the AMA and the TMA, insurance companies would frown on you.
Blue Cross Blue Shield insured the majority of people in Texas. If your hospital was not approved by the local association, they would pay the doctor portion of the bill, but not the hospital portion of the bill. So all of my dad's patients, as they were billed, they paid for the doctor, but not for the hospital. He just absorbed that.
Dad was a good physician. He had a wonderful rapport with his patients and with his workers. So as small as he was still a threat.